On this World Refugee Day, we look at what people throughout Illinois are doing to help resettle refugees throughout our state. We start in Rock Island.
We also want to do a moment of silence for those who have made the journey or tried to make the journey, and the journey has been too hard. Whether they got bit by a snake going through the jungle, whether they had to cross the desert and never made it to the next country. And so let's take a moment of silence and just honor those refugees today.
Later, we'll check in with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights and the U.S. State Department. We're also marking the summer solstice by talking gardening, especially straw bale gardening. For those of you just starting out, we also have experts to answer your questions.
Start on a smaller scale, and as you become more confident and grow in your knowledge of gardening, your garden naturally will follow.
Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show, and we'll take your questions coming up next. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone had a great weekend. And today is the longest day of the year as we mark the summer solstice. Today also marks the start of National Pollinator Week. And planting a garden is a great way to provide a habitat for pollinators. Think birds, bees, butterflies, or bats. Today, for this first part of today's show, we're talking about gardening. And we've lined up a few horticulture experts to answer your questions. If you have any questions about gardening, especially beginning gardening, we're also going to be talking about straw bale gardening. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21st Show. That's 21ST Show on Twitter. Joining me now are two University of Illinois Extension horticulture educators. On the line with us from Northwest Illinois in Galva is Martha Smith. And all the way due south of her in Collinsville is Elizabeth Wally. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Nice to be here.
Good morning. Martha, let's start with you. During the spring, I know people spend hours cleaning up their gardening and dividing and planting and mulching and fertilizing. Now that we're into June, maybe is this a time for gardeners to take a more leisurely approach and spend more time enjoying their garden?
With June, I hope people can slow down and get out to enjoy their garden because, you know, there is some work involved with getting it up and ready. This time of year, you know, it's also a great time to get ideas. I know several communities have garden walks. You can go to botanic gardens. So, yeah, June is a time to, you know, maybe slow down and, you know, take the time to really look at what's out there and maybe get some ideas for yourself.
And this is also a good time for planting perennials. Why is that, Martha?
You know, in June, you know, the mad rush of May is over with. We're usually getting fairly nice temperatures, though this June has been extremely hot. And we usually are getting, ample rainfall. The plants at the garden centers, they've had some time to fill out, so you can actually, you know, see more of the plant and get an idea of what it's going to look like. Some plants, such as your ornamental grasses, some of your warm season grasses, they don't look like much in a container in early May. But as the heat kicks in, now they start to fill out. So people get, you know, they get a good selection. They're going to see more of a plant, so that there's going to be this feeling that you're getting more of a value. And it's a great time to plant. Get them in the ground. You're going to have to watch your watering for, a good three and a half weeks. You want to make sure that they get anchored in. And then it's pretty much let them go and see how they do.
So you really just need a couple of weeks to pay attention to those, and then it's okay. You can...
Well, if we have a drought, I mean, there's always the variables. I mean, if we don't have rain, well, yeah, you do. But a lot of times when people put a new plant in the garden, you're bringing it in a media that grower selected, and you're putting it into your soil. And a lot of times what people will say, you know, I planted that, and I watered it in, and then I came back the next week, and it was all dried out. Well, that media is going to dry out very quickly compared to the natural soil. So I always tell people, no, you got to babysit those plants for a good, you know, three and a half weeks just to get them so their roots now start to anchor out into that natural soil. Then it's kind of just get out and watch. And if you haven't had rain and they're wilting, that's your good sign to get out the hoses.
I see some tweets, and I want to get to one of those in a minute. A few questions. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. As you're saying babysit, we got a tweet from Double Digger saying, this year's garden's gone to ruin because we're busy with the baby, and some of our perennials have had a tough time. Is there such a thing, Martha, as we're starting to think about, is there such a thing as a low-maintenance garden, or as you're talking about a perennial that takes care of itself and you maybe can just pay attention to it for a couple of weeks? What other tips are there for people who maybe may not have as much time this summer?
Well, there are definitely lower maintenance plants. You know, you see a lot of daylilies. You see a lot of hosta. You see a lot of daisies. And these are common plants because they generally do well and look fairly good, you know, when they're in bloom. Now, with perennials, you've got to realize they have a season of bloom. So it's not going to be, you know, the visual display all season. So if you're going to want that visual display all season, then you have to have a spring bloomer, a summer bloomer, and a fall bloomer. And you can also incorporate some annuals in there because they'll bloom all season. So, you know, for things, yes, there are low maintenance. There, you do have to get out and take some minimal care to them versus... There are some plants in my garden, delphiniums. I tried them, 3 strikes, they're out, and they're out of my garden just because they're more finicky. I finally have got a troleus to bloom in my garden after many, many years, but I had to baby it and find the right spot. So, you know, there's plants for all levels.
Right, right. Elizabeth, I know eventually we want to learn more from you about straw bale gardening, which is exactly what it sounds like, planting an entire garden in a bale of straw. But as Martha's been talking about flower gardens, I wanted to ask you about what tips you have for someone who wants to start a vegetable garden.
Well, in this time of the year, we're in the warm season, so I think for beginning vegetable gardeners, the first thing I would tell them is to make sure that they're selecting vegetables at this time that really like warmth.
Like what?
So we would be looking at things like tomatoes, watermelons, green beans. All of those really like warmth. The things that they'll want to stay away from at this point until we get a lot further into the season when they can start a fall garden are those that like cooler temperatures. So anything that's like a broccoli, cauliflower, cabbages, anything in that family, peas, you know, garden peas, all of those really like really cool temperatures. And so if we were to plant those in the heat that we have right now, they would tend to have a tendency to do what we call bolting, which is instead of producing what we want them to produce, they would produce a flower stalk. And so a lot of times when we have things like leaf lettuces, they can be, if they bolt, they can become bitter. Things like radishes become very woody and not as desirable in terms of taste. And so if you're planting a garden now, go for the things that just really love heat.
If you've never ever grown a vegetable before, do you think a tomato plant is a good thing to start with?
You know, there are always, you know, tomato is always called, you know, the favorite garden plant. And that's one of the reasons, because it's pretty tough and it's very tolerant of beginning gardeners in terms of handling it. It can go so far as that you can plant it too deep, you can plant it too shallow, you can plant it at an angle, and it will do well. Even slightly break the stem, and if you plant it deep enough, it will go ahead and root and do well. So in that regard, it is very tolerant of new handling or new growers. It does have a few problems, you know, in terms of disease and insect pests that all gardeners have to deal with, but in terms of establishing, it definitely would be a beginner plant.
Mm-hmm. You know, you said bolting. Can you explain what that means?
Well, plants that are cool season plants, when it gets warm, they get a signal that says, oh, it's time to flower. And so bolting is when a plant goes into that flowering mode. And so they elongate and develop their flower structure, produce a flower, and then develop seed. And when it moves from into the flowering stage, it usually has, you know, if it's the leaf that you're eating, the leaves have a tendency to take on more of a bitterness, and a good example would be spinach. spinach is a very early season crop. If you were to seed it right now, instead of staying nice and leafy, the plant would go into bolting, and that would be sending up a flower shoot to produce seed. But the leaves just kind of take on a tougher texture, and they just don't taste as desirable.
And they do they look the same?
They kind of look a little rougher, somewhat different than when you would plant it in the very early spring. So they're not as, you know, tender and juicy looking. They just kind of have a rougher texture to them. They're just not as palatable.
That's Elizabeth Wally. Martha Smith is also with us. Both of them are horticultural educators with the University of Illinois Extension. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We got a tweet from Elaine. This is a great question because she wanted to know what is a weed? How does she know what a weed is? And I feel like I have to add, my entire front lawn right now is embarrassingly just dandelion weeds. I'm a little embarrassed by that. So is there a way to combat this? Also, just first, how to distinguish what's a weed and what's not a weed. And some people, I know there are flowering weeds that now I see in like in farmers markets that people are selling. So who wants to tackle that one?
Well, I've always defined a weed as a plant out of place. So what is a weed to one person might very well be something desirable to somebody else. So, you know, really, it's if it's something that is growing where you don't want it or it's something that you didn't plant, then you might consider that a weed and want to get rid of it because that's a plant that's going to compete for sunlight, for food, for moisture. It could, you know, overgrow your plants and shade them out. So really, I guess it's, you know, your personal choice of what isn't supposed to be there. I don't know. What's your definition, Elizabeth?
Well, I'm kind of the same way you are, Martha. In garden, we, you know, tackle several different weeds, ones that are the ones that we did not plant at all. They're not even, you know, not even spreading from a plant that we did plant. And that comes down to, you know, if you have to buy weed books to be able to identify seedlings, you know, when they have weed books now, they're very good about putting pictures of what they look like as seedlings so that you're able to identify what we, you know, would consider a true weed. But as Martha talks about, that really a lot of times is more the weeds that we deal with in our garden is the plants that we planted are a little more aggressive than they thought they were, and it comes down to, as Martha said, is it desirable or not? And so I have, even in my own garden, a lot of plants that I planted and some I love, and I just let them spread in waves. Once I've recognized what they look like, I know which ones to keep. And then there are others that are, oh my goodness, they're taking over the yard. And so I am aggressively removing something that maybe I initiated. So I'm in agreement with Martha. It really, you know, comes down to whether it's something that is acceptable to you or not. I think all of us recognize weeds like dandelions, but as Martha mentioned, it's whether you like it because dandelion greens are edible. Maybe some people want to eat those. So there's some value in a lot of weeds for eating as well, but there are some that are quite poisonous, so you have to know what you're doing.
We just got a question on Twitter from Bree. Elizabeth, I think this is for you. Any fix for tomatoes with septoria? Bree says the leaves are yellowing and dying.
Well, one of the things, you know, obviously we have listeners that want to be organic using organic means and those that are willing to use conventional pesticides. So, you know, I'll address the easiest way for conventional pesticides. You know, chlorothalonil is an active ingredient that, you know, sprayed regularly according to the label can prevent it. Now, if you want to stay away from using, you know, conventional pesticides, some of the things that we want to do with the tomato is that we would mulch at the base so that we're trying to prevent rain splashing of the soil that might have some residual from disease last year that was in the soil splashing up onto your new plants. And so by putting something like a straw mulch, we can kind of block that raindrop from splashing disease particles. So that's kind of somewhat of a preventive measure on there as well. And also, when we're doing planting, we want to make sure that we have not planted too close together because we want rapid drying conditions, again, to try and not create conditions that disease likes. And they usually like to have free moisture on the leaves. So with tomatoes, if you can have nice spacing so that there's good airflow through them, and sometimes that includes pruning them, which is removing some of the suckers on the plant. If you have determinant tomatoes, I would recommend that you remove all of the suckers below the first cluster to somewhat open up the canopy. And if you have indeterminate types, we usually remove all suckers and kind of train them as either one or two stems on those. So the main thing is block rain splashing and also to open up the canopy so that you have rapid air drying you're not going to use fungicides.
Thanks for that. Keep the tweets, and if you want to call, our number is 1-800-222-9455. We just have a minute before we take a break, but Martha, I just wanted to ask you, it's the beginning of National Pollinator Week, and when we're thinking about providing habitats for birds or bees or butterflies or bats, what are some, can you just give us three tips really quickly, three things you could think of for pollinator gardens before we take a break?
With a pollinator garden, of course, you want to have the blooms. Most of the experts will say that a flat-topped flower, not a big double ruffled flower, tends to be better for pollinators because they can get in there and get to the pollen.
Like a sunflower.
Yeah, sunflower, but nothing like a big double fluffled zinnia. They wouldn't be able to get their get down in there. The other thing with pollinator gardens is you don't have to have them be pristine. You really need to leave some open soil because a lot of them are ground dwellers. And I leave some of my stems up from last year because several pollinators lay eggs in the canes.
Oh, great. Okay, when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about gardening. Keep the questions and calls coming. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about gardening. In particular, it's National Pollinator Week. We were just talking about how to plant a garden that's great to provide habitats for birds and bees and butterflies. We also want to talk about straw bale gardening, and we're taking your questions for the next few minutes. If you want to keep those tweets coming to 21st Show, on the line with us, Martha Smith and Elizabeth Wally are both horticulture educators with the University of Illinois Extension. Martha, I just wanted you to finish your thought about pollinators. We were starting with tips about planting friendly gardens. You were talking about flat flowers. What else is important too?
Well, there's a wide diversity of pollinators that are out there. The majority of our native pollinators, they're not really large. They're not really showy. So you're going to see a lot of different, bees and things that look, more like wasps. And that's good. That's what you want to have in your garden. With butterflies, they too will visit the flowers in the garden. But with butterflies, you also have to provide food for the larval stage. There is a caterpillar stage, and if you're going to have butterflies in your garden, you have to accept that you're going to have some munching. Parsley, I plant lots of parsley in my garden. I don't eat a lot of parsley, but it's the larval food for one of the swallowtails. So I hope to see the little caterpillars just munching away, because then I know I'm going to be rewarded with them later. If people see those guys munching on the parsley and say, oh, I've got to get rid of those, then they do something to get rid of the munching caterpillar, then they wonder why they don't have
butterflies.
There's the sphinx moths and the hummingbird moths that are also pollinators. And for the larval stage, it's the tomato hornworm. So people that see that big tomato hornworm eating their tomatoes think, oh, I got to get rid of it. And then they wonder why they never see the sphinx or the hawk moths or the hummingbird moths. So there is a little bit of education when it comes to the butterflies, because people have to understand there's the two life stages.
Martha, do all plants that bloom provide nectar for pollinators?
You know, that's a good question. There are some plants that only produce nectar, and there are some plants that only produce pollen. But the plants, you know, don't know. I mean, the pollinators don't know that. They're still going to visit and frequent the flowers, and what they're really trying to do is just get the pollen onto them so that they can transfer it to another female part of the flower or to a completely different flower. But yes, there are some that just only have one and not the other, and then the vast majority have both.
Elizabeth, for gardeners who have perhaps limited mobility or limited space to garden, there's a technique known as straw barrel gardening that requires just a few basic materials. How do you grow a garden in a bale of straw?
Well, it is really fascinating. I've been doing it myself, and as you mentioned, it's wonderful for those that can't bend down or get down. It brings the garden up a little bit higher for accessibility. And if you don't have either your soil is not good or you just don't have enough ground for a garden, you can just put it in a driveway and grow it as well. But, you know, a straw bale garden is made out of straw, obviously, and that's a material that when you expose it to rain will start composting. And if you're familiar with composting at all, that really heats up before it's the carbon in the straw starts breaking down. And so with straw bale gardening, the first steps of it for about 2 weeks is that you have to purposefully compost the straw, get through that heating up phase before you plant any plants in it. Because if you were to plant directly into a straw bale while it was composting, it could possibly overheat and kill the plants that you put in it. So there is a preparing stage before you can plant in a straw bale.
Is this a good time of year to begin a straw bale garden? Does it matter? As you were talking about, and I was thinking about external temperatures, I don't know if that makes a difference for composting.
It really doesn't. It is kind of interesting. This year I tried, because I somewhat had that same question, I started my straw bale composting it in February when temperatures in the St. Louis area were still dropping well below freezing at night. And I was in day two, the straw bale had already heated up to 80 degrees. And so you can definitely do it in very early spring and have your straw bale ready to go. You can do it now and composting, and it would go through the process very quickly with temperatures that we have now. And so this is something that you can, you know, do for early spring garden, a summer garden, if you want to prepare it for a fall garden. That's one of the other nice features of having a straw bale garden.
So do you just go buy an old straw bale and get started?
You can buy an old straw bale. You can buy a brand new straw bale. The main thing that I would say is once you have your straw bales, positioning is rather important because it requires you to wet the straw bale thoroughly, and they become very heavy when they're that wet. And so when you're doing it, you want to, however you're going to design, you know, if you want to make a labyrinth or if you just want to have one straw bale or several, you know, lined up in a design, I would recommend, though, that underneath of the straw bales that you put several layers of newspaper or landscaping fabric if you're on an area where weeds can come up through. So that'll somewhat help you with weed control. But once you have them in place, then the first step that you're going to want to do is thoroughly wet your bale of straw. And by thoroughly wet, I mean stand over it with a hose and just keep watering until you finally see water come out the
bottom. So you really need to soak it. Okay.
You really need to soak it. And it takes quite a bit to get a straw bale wet. And as with a compost pile, then you need to initiate composting of a straw bale. And there are several recipes, and there are a number of books on this, but the main concept is that you need to be applying a nitrogen-containing fertilizer. So if they just use something like a 12-12-12, just a general grade of fertilizer, I would recommend if they use something like that, that each straw bale would get 2 cups, just, you know, uniformly spread across the top, lightly watered in. And so that is your first application of fertilizer. And then every other day, add maybe a cup more to each bale. But every day, you're going to water. So, and you'll do this for probably 2 weeks. So every other day, you'll add a little more fertilizer and just water it in a little bit. You don't want to overwater because that would flush the fertilizer out. And you really need the fertilizer in the bale to act as a food source for the microorganisms that start the compost.
Right, because obviously there's no dirt, right?
Right.
Interesting.
There's no dirt, so okay. You need to provide moisture for them.
We tweeted out a link with more information from the University of Illinois Extension that has more information on straw bale gardening. So if you follow the 21st on Twitter, if you head to 21st Show, www.21stshow.org, we'll have all of that up at the end of the program as well. I want to thank Martha Smith and Elizabeth Wally for joining us from all parts of the state, but both working for as horticultural educators for the University of Illinois Extension to talk to us about gardening. Thank you, ladies.
Thanks, Nyla.
Welcome back to the 21st. Today we observe World Refugee Day. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reports that more people are displaced by rising violence, insecurity, and persecution than at any time on record. President Obama said earlier today that adds up to more than 65 million people across the world. That's more than the populations of France, California, and Texas combined being driven from their homes. More than half of those are children. We're going to talk now about how Illinois is resettling refugees. Later, we're going to be joined by the State Department, and they're going to talk about the national climate for welcoming and resettling refugees. But first, over the weekend, the 21st Ben Thomas Paine visited Black Hawk State Historic Site in Rock Island. On Saturday, several hundred Quad City residents gathered to walk through the trails and an event organized by World Relief in honor of today.
As you know, around the world, there's a lot of stuff that's happening that's just not good. And not everybody gets to go to a second or a third country where they can go, oh, I'm free. We also want to do a moment of silence for those who have made the journey or tried to make the journey and the journey has been too hard, whether they got bit by a snake going through the jungle, whether they got shot by a soldier on their way of fleeing, whether they had to cross the desert and never made it to the next country. And so let's take a moment of silence and just honor those refugees today.
We also spoke with Esther Williams. That's her American name. She's about to start her junior year at Rock Island High, and she told us it's very different from her school in her native Myanmar.
Back in my home country, the school is kind of like we just sit in one place, and we don't really move to anywhere for the whole day. So it's just basically in one room, and only like teachers and move around. And we're really, really scared of teachers. Teachers are like our second parents. So we don't even dare to look at them face to face or talk to them like that. So here I was like really surprised. I'm like, oh, really? You can talk to a teacher like that? And, you know, I'm like, okay, yeah, that was funny. That was really funny to me.
In the past 40 years, Illinois has resettled more than 145,000 refugees from more than 60 countries. Joining us now to talk about how Illinois is receiving and resettling refugees from Chicago, Selena Villanueva is with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Selena, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Where are most refugees in Illinois coming from right now? What countries?
I mean, it runs the gamut. Like, we're talking about people that are coming from, you know, war-torn countries or fleeing violence. So we have refugees that are arriving from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Sorry. You have other places, other folks that are coming from Myanmar. So, you know, we have folks that are coming from Africa, from East Asia, from Southeast Asia. We have folks, and then depending on how you categorize them, we have people that are coming from Central America and fleeing the violence from there.
Mm-hmm. We certainly heard particularly Illinois Representative Luis Gutierrez talking about Central American refugees last week. We've heard about Syrian refugees.
Yes.
Do you think the current definition of who qualifies as a refugee is sufficient?
I don't think it is. I think that the term is very nuanced. I think that we have to consider a lot of different things in terms of what's happening in foreign policy and what's happening across the world, because, you know, what's happening in Central America is a crisis. It's a serious situation that has been exacerbated by foreign policy, and we have women, children, families that are fleeing their countries, because it's a huge decision to decide to leave everything that you know, your language, your culture, to come somewhere just to feel safe.
Selena, I wonder how you think politics, let's start in Springfield. How are politics in Springfield affecting refugees in Illinois?
Well, I mean, you gotta talk about it like this. There is no state budget. We're in the middle of a state budget crisis where our legislators are not and have not been able to agree on terms. We have, two parties that are kind of at war with each other, and this is preventing good policy that would help protect families that are leaving, again, war-torn countries, you know, from actually being able to get the resources that they need in order to do, you know, in order just to live. And
yeah,
and
how
to
is
be okay.
It? How is it affecting them? Because I think most people think, oh, that's federal pass-through money. We think a lot of the state budget situation, things are getting funded. Is it affecting social service agencies that would be helping?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you got to think about it like this. There are agencies that are closing down or have had to minimize the services that they provide for both immigrants and refugees in the state of Illinois because of the budget impasse. So less people that can help to provide those services. Well, yes, the president has, it's at the president's discretion as to, you know, how many refugees are allowed into the country. It's still up to the state as to how they provide those services like resettlement, you know, housing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, this budget impasse still impacts people because it isn't just about, you know, being able to provide for folks and helping to resettle, but it's also about the policy to make sure that people feel safe and feel protected. And at the end of the day, that the state government is actually working for people.
In your view, what should happen next? What would you like to see happen to help refugees, particularly in Illinois?
I think we just got to work to get a state budget. Again, we got to free up those resources to make sure that organizations that are providing these services can actually are up and running and they have the people and the capacity to be able to provide what they need to provide. Again, you know, at the end of the day, we have to think about it like this. There are so many things going on in the world, but the folks that are trying to come here are trying to flee for their lives. They're fleeing very desperate situations, and they just want to be safe. So we need a budget, and we need folks to remember that, again, it's really difficult. You're trying to come here. You're trying to learn a new language. So for people that are interested, there's so many organizations where they can volunteer and help out. But at the end of the day, we need a budget and a resolution and actually legislators that are friendly to the plight of refugees in Illinois.
That's Selena Villanueva with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Thanks, Selena.
Thank you very much.
We wanted to also get a national view on World Refugee Day. And joining us now, Heather Higginbottom is with the U.S. State Department. She works on refugee issues, among other things, but her official title is Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources, and joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Deputy Secretary, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me, Nyla.
We're talking about these numbers, more than 60 million people right now who have been forced for their homes because of some sort of persecution or political violence. What do you see as the United States' role in this kind of refugee crisis that we're facing worldwide?
We play a really important role. First, we are the largest provider of humanitarian aid in the world. We also have the largest refugee resettlement program in the world. So we play a very, very important role. But it's also true that we need, because of the scale and scope of the crisis, we need more countries establishing or expanding refugee resettlement programs and more countries providing resources to the countries that are hosting refugees and to the refugees themselves. So I think the scale and scope of the crisis requires U.S. leadership as well as other countries around the world.
We're going to take a break. When I come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Heather Higginbottom with the U.S. Department of State from Washington, D.C. It's World Refugee Day, as we're talking about how not just Illinois, but the U.S. welcomes and is dealing with refugees. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On this World Refugee Day, we've been talking about Springfield and Washington and how actions there are affecting refugees throughout the country. Joining me from Washington is Heather Higginbottom. She's a Deputy Secretary of State with the U.S. Department of State. Deputy Secretary, you were just saying before the break, we were talking about the United States' role in refugee and sort of resettling refugees and also providing aid. I know the Obama administration is committed to bringing in 10,000 Syrian refugees before the end of September. A couple weeks ago, one of our senators from Illinois, Senator Durbin, joined a group of other senators asking for an update on where we stand with that commitment. Where are we at with that?
Well, we're on track to meet that goal. We've committed to admitting 85,000 refugees this fiscal year in total, at least 10,000 of which will be Syrian. And we're in a very busy time when we're bringing lots of people before the end of the fiscal year, and we feel very confident that we're going to reach that 10,000 number this year.
We heard a few minutes ago from an Illinois organization working to help refugees, and one of the things she said was that she felt the federal definition of refugee was too narrow to meet the global demand, and specifically she was talking about Central America. What would your response be to that?
Well, I think it's really important for us to use the opportunity of World Refugee Day to highlight that we are facing the greatest migration crisis. It's really at historical levels, and that includes refugees and migrants all around the world. We've been very focused on the plight of people, many unaccompanied children and families making the dangerous journey from Central America to the United States, which is why we've set up an in-country refugee processing program for certain categories of minors to come to the United States safely and securely. And we're very focused on ensuring we're providing those supports and that the incentives to come and make that dangerous journey don't lead young people to take advantage of very dangerous routes. And so we're very concerned about it. We've also increased our foreign assistance funding, our financing, to address the root causes of both the violence and lack of economic opportunity in Central America. And we think that over a slightly longer window is really what's necessary to ensure that those countries are safe and that people can remain there.
I know, of course, this isn't the jurisdiction of the State Department, but as we look at immigrants and refugees and people seeking asylum here, we've seen reports in the past few weeks about how the backlog of cases is about a 3-year delay for people to be granted asylum in the U.S. court system. Is that something that the State Department finds frustrating as you all are on the beginning end of this and bringing people in as they come into the U.S. system? How do you all handle those delays?
Well, on the refugee program, on the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, that process takes about a year, sometimes a year and a half, and that's because we have a very thorough screening and security and vetting process. But we're working really hard to ensure we're putting safety and security first, but we're taking every opportunity we can to get people here quickly. You know, in our refugee admissions program, we really prioritize the most vulnerable refugees. Over the last 10 years, 60% of refugees admitted to the United States were women and children. And we think World Refugee Day is a really important opportunity to get the facts out about the program and ultimately to encourage more Americans to be a part of it. And that's why we teamed up with the Ad Council today in launching their campaign called Welcome Refugees, which is intended to provide information to people with questions about the program, as well as opportunities to get involved.
Well, when you talk about information, you have a candidate for President Donald Trump who's saying very, very clearly and sort of even in the past week and a half has been much more emphatic about saying that Muslims need to be screened before they come into this country, particularly with the shooting in Orlando last week, saying even though he was American, his family shouldn't have been let in. How is the current political climate making this more difficult for what you all are trying to do for resettling refugees?
I think it's really important that we have an opportunity to get the facts out about the program. And I think there has been a lot of misinformation out in the public, and that's why the new website that's part of the Ad Council's campaign, it's called embracerefugees.org. And that website has a lot of information that can answer people's questions about the program. So it includes things like who we bring in, how we prioritize very vulnerable people, and also the very rigorous security screening that any refugee has to go through. It's not a well-known fact that refugees are traveling to the United States are the most thoroughly screened of any traveler coming to this country. So it's a real opportunity to get information out about the program and allay concerns or questions that people have about the program. And that's why we think it's a really important opportunity today on World Refugee Day to raise awareness of the program and also provide information to people with questions.
Obviously it sounds like this is really about providing information and facts for people. Are there other ways you want local communities to get involved?
Well, the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program depends on local organizations. There is a network of 350 community-based organizations around the country. And when a refugee or a refugee family is going to be placed in a particular community, it's that local, that community-based organization that's going to meet the refugee and provide supports, whether it's helping to find a place to live or providing donated furniture or clothes or registering students for school. So those community-based organizations are really the backbone of this program, and this is an opportunity for people to learn about the program and how to get connected with those organizations so that we can really broaden the base of people across the country who are welcoming refugees.
That's Heather Higginbottom. She's a Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources with the U.S. Department of State, joining us from Washington. Thanks so much, Deputy Secretary.
Thank you so much for having me.
Continuing on with politics, Speaker Dennis Hassert is set to enter prison. Former U.S. Speaker of the House Dennis Hassert is set to enter prison in about 48 hours from now. Hillary Clinton's relying on some big money bundlers in Chicago, and we wanted to talk about how much the Illinois budget stalemate is also affecting women. Those are just a few Illinois political headlines we're talking about, as we do every Monday at this time, with a few political reporters. Mike Ryopel is the Daily Herald's political editor, and he's joining us from their bureau in the Capitol. And on the line with us from Chicago is AP political reporter Sarah Burnett. Sarah, Mike, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's talk about former U.S. House Speaker. He, Mike, as you were just writing about, becomes the highest-ranking U.S. official to enter prison. That will happen when he surrenders on Wednesday. Horrific crimes. And, of course, a reminder, he wasn't actually convicted of sexual abuse. He was convicted of bank violations. Mike, I wanted to ask you about what kind of statement you think it sends that the highest-ranking official in the U.S. to ever go to prison also happens to be another Illinois politician.
Well, I think it probably feeds the cynicism a lot of Illinois voters have. You know, this guy, the former speaker, is not somebody who'd been thought of as a potential candidate for prison, I think, for most of his tenure. And like you said, he was not going to prison on any corruption crimes. It's because of this banking provision in the Patriot Act that he helped pass that basically says you can't hide, you can't try to hide how you take your money out of your bank. And so he'll go to prison. I think the nature of his being a high-ranking official is probably a trivial matter to the victims and the people who worked with him over the years, but it's an important part of history to kind of know to where this fits in history.
Sure. The Tribune and ABC 7 in Chicago are both reporting he's going to be surrendering to a medical prison facility in Rochester, Minnesota. Sarah, what do we know about the former speaker's health and how much that factored into where at least a few news organizations are reporting he will be sent to?
Yeah, sure. You know, his attorneys have said that he is not well. I think most of us saw the images of him, you know, in a wheelchair coming in and out of court. He is obviously much thinner, does not look a lot like the kind of jovial former wrestling coach that we used to see. He had
some type of blood infection.
Some sort of sepsis is what his attorney said,
yeah.
Right?
And a minor stroke. And his team handed over all kinds of information about his health. And that was a factor when Judge Durkin sentenced him. And Durkin was, persuaded enough that the health problems are serious and real that he recommended the type of prison that folks are reporting that he'll be going to.
Right. In fact, he said during
placed in a medical facility.
Yeah, he said during the sentencing, right, we know that you were ill. We have prison specifically for people with your health issues.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And he made clear, you know, that, yes, he believed it and everything, but that was not a reason for him not to go to prison,
mm-hmm.
that there are facilities that are equipped to deal with this, and they do it all the time.
And so, Mike, the timing of this is Wednesday he has to surrender?
He has to surrender by Wednesday. I guess you could go early if you wanted to, but that's right. I believe it's 2 p.m. Wednesday he has to be in there by.
Let's switch topics and just go to a little bit more national politics in the presidential campaign. Sarah, I know Chicago fundraisers were very important for President Obama. The Sun-Times is reporting about Hillary Clinton and who's raising big bucks for her in Chicago. Before you get into who's raising big bucks for her in Chicago, Sarah, can you remind everybody what a bundler is? And I think because we see this, it's this time of year when we're going to start seeing bundlers who are making money. What does that mean?
Sure. A bundler is basically another fundraiser who goes out and talks to their friends and wealthy strangers and anybody else who they can persuade to give money. And then that money is then given to the campaign. And the bundler himself or herself kind of gets credit for those donations. And so it's sort of a pride thing would maybe be a funny way to say it, but you know, people are kind of competing to be one of the biggest bundlers, and then we've seen over time that sometimes those people are rewarded in other ways after a candidate is elected with, you know,
right. And certainly we've seen like the Pritzker
like
family be big in the bundling space for Obama, same time around for Hillary Clinton.
Yes. J.B. Pritzker is involved. It's a lot of the same folks who supported Obama, as you would expect. Fred Eichaner, the Pritzker family, obviously. And a lot of what these folks are doing is holding events, things either the Sun-Times story today is about a party at J.B. Pritzker's home. Some people, you know, those events can be high-priced fundraisers in the $50,000 range, or they can be like a $100 a person dinner at a restaurant or something like that.
And is Donald Trump raising much external money in Illinois? I don't know. I mean, it's kind of interesting. We haven't heard very much conversations about external money he's raising in general, so I'm not sure how much would be in Illinois.
Sure. Not much at all, and certainly compared with both Hillary Clinton and even Bernie Sanders. So Clinton so far has raised in Illinois about $6 million. Donald Trump has raised about $90,000.
In fact,
he hasn't really been trying, though.
I was going to say there are actually quite a few Illinois Republicans who were spending money against Donald Trump, at least in the primaries. Mm-hmm. Are we going to continue to see, for example, the Ricketts family, owner of the Cubs? Are we going to continue to see those kind of things now, or have they quieted down?
I think that the anti-Trump spending has pretty much stopped at this point. I think some, you know, folks are pretty much who were trying to do that have resigned themselves to the fact that he's the nominee. Where Trump is going to have problems, and what we're seeing already, is that a lot of them are just sitting the election out. They're just not going to donate. And so you have, you know, someone like the Ricketts or the Uline family or folks who, you know, historically have been big donors to the Republican candidate for president who just aren't going to be giving him money.
Mike, we just have a minute left, but just wanted to ask you really quickly, what's going on this week in Springfield, what you're sort of keeping an eye on this week or next week?
Well, we are waiting to see if the House or Senate will come into session on Wednesday. When they left in May after blowing a budget deadline, they said, the speaker said, our quote-unquote continuous session will be every Wednesday going forward. They have
not met any Wednesday yet,
so we'll see. The fiscal year ends June 30th, so that's the next signpost on the march toward the longest budget impasse in history. So we'll see if they come in Wednesday.
Mike Riopelle is the political editor at the Daily Herald, joining us from their bureau in the Capitol in Springfield. Thanks also to Sarah Burnett, who covers Chicago and Illinois politics for the AP, joining us from Chicago. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, the Annie E. Casey Foundation is releasing state-by-state rankings of child poverty. We're going to be talking about where Illinois ranks, so tune into that. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.